Coming up on Boston Public Radio, whether it's the Philippines or the Atlantic coast, huge storms are taking a horrible toll, and climate change is back on page one. But is there the will to do anything about it? We'll also talk about the relationship between two phone buddies, Cardinal O'Malley and Pope Francis, and whether conservative Catholics have a legitimate beef with the pontiff. And then, one of my favorite issues, lunch. Are you so busy you dine al desco or don't eat lunch at all? If you think that makes you more productive, you'd be wrong.
Okay. The Boston Globe's Alex Beam on how Amazon, the everything store, hopes to take over the TV business. Then ask the pilot Patrick Smith. He'll take your calls on everything from airline mergers to keeping your electronic devices, or most of them anyway, on during takeoff and landing and everything else. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So every night we all see the pictures. The devastation in the Philippines following Typhoon Haiyan has put climate change back on the front page. It's also pushed another story into the headlines, and that's how poorer nations, which cause far less of the problem, bear the biggest brunt of global warming calamities. And there's a similar gap between rich and poor within the United States itself. Joining us on the line to explain why this is and if we can do anything about it to offset climate change inequities is Daniel Schrag. He's a professor of geology and director of Harvard University's Center for the Environment. Dan Schrag, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello.
Thank you for being here, Professor. So I'm wondering, is anybody disputing this basic thesis that the countries that pollute the most are suffering the least? And the ones that pollute the least are suffering the most. Anybody disputing that?
Well, I think that's a little simplistic. I think that there's no question the big emitters, U.S. and China, for example, are still going to suffer. And sometimes, I mean, China, for example, which is the largest emitter in the world, their people may suffer enormously if there are huge droughts that cause food shortages, for example. But I think there's been a recognition for a long time that there are a lot of very poor countries, for example, most of sub-Saharan Africa, that really has contributed almost nothing to the climate problem and yet are going to suffer enormously because of it.
And we've been reading about conferences in which these nations that are suffering the most because of it are making pleas for some sort of international compensation or reparations, for lack of a better expression. But it's a nice discussion point, but that's not even remotely part of the United States or China's agenda, is it?
Well, actually, we agreed in a previous negotiation, the world agreed, the developed countries, to give $100 billion in international development, partly to deal with climate change. Most countries are sort of stepping back from that. The U.S. gives a lot of foreign aid, and certainly some of that is being focused on helping countries prepare for the impacts of climate change. But really, you know, it's a broader question about poverty and international development.
And also, just to put the $100 billion in context, what did Congress appropriate for Hurricane Sandy? $60 or $70 billion for the after effects of one storm, right?
I don't think it's terribly surprising that we're willing to pay a lot more for damage to our own city than to development overseas.
So can we talk about Typhoon Haiyan for a second as sort of an object lesson here? This is why the discussion is back in the news, and I'm sure it'll be back yet again, sadly, and then yet again in the future. Do the Philippines have a case to make?
Attributing any single storm to climate change is impossible. There are typhoons that have hit the Philippines in the past, and there will be. They would have happened anyway without climate change. Everything in the climate system is being affected by climate change because as the Earth heats up, it affects every aspect, but often in ways that are difficult to quantify. So it's very difficult to try to attribute specific percentage of the damage from this recent typhoon to climate change. I don't think that the international legal case for damages is really going to be the one that's most persuasive. I think it's more the general sense that people are now sitting in harm's way where they have lived for centuries, and now because of climate change, it's really threatening lots and lots of communities around the world. You know, Bangladesh was always the poster child for sea level rise, for example. And it's true, Bangladesh is, you know, tens of millions of people are going to have to move because the sea level continues to rise. That's something we've imposed on that, you know, on future generations in perpetuity.
Well, it does seem to me, I mean, I don't mean to sound like a total Pollyanna here, but as more and more people realize the devastation, you have this guy in the Philippines talking, one of these climate negotiators saying that their GDP is greatly impacted every year by these terrible storms. So there's a huge moral argument here that there is some obligation by the richer countries, even though we're going to face issues with climate change in the United States and China and every place else. But there is a moral argument that I think may be attractive to more people as they realize what the devastation means. I mean, we've been hearing terrible stories from the Philippines, and you think, my God, they're not in a position in many cases to build the kind of structures that could help them withstand or to do anything about it.
You know, I think if people around the world in developed countries are sympathetic to the suffering of people in some of these areas hit by natural disasters and weather-related disasters affected by climate change, I think, and if that leads to more political will to actually solve the problem and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, that would be a wonderful thing. I think sometimes this view is overstated because, again, our own country is suffering a lot. You know, a year ago, we spent over $100 billion on weather-related disasters, $65 billion for Sandy, and then another $20 or $25 billion on the drought, the big drought across the entire country, 50% of U.S. counties under emergency drought conditions. It's not cheap. It's really expensive for our country, and we're still not willing to do much. So if sympathy for Philippines helps, that's wonderful. I've got to say, I'm a little concerned that it's not enough to really do the sort of things we need to do.
When you say, you're talking about the United States, and let's talk about its citizenry for a moment, it seems to me there's a Pogo-esque problem here, and I'm talking about the media, I'm not talking about real people. It's just the other night, I was talking to Marjorie, maybe on the air about this, there was a segment on the Philippines and climate change on Piers Morgan on CNN. And there's a reporter, I wish I could remember his name, and you probably know him, one with a guy from Georgia who I think used to work for NASA. And the reporter kept saying in response to every question, Piers, you're engaging in journalistic malpractice. The fact that you're having a one-on-one discussion, one person who believes that climate change is primarily a function or in great part a function of human activity, and on the other side, with equal stature, somebody who denies that, a climate denier, even though the guy said he wasn't such a thing. Isn't that one of the reasons why the United States is in such a mess on this thing? Because what we're fed as consumers of news is on one hand and then on the other.
I think that's certainly a contribution, and certainly I agree with you. The media gets some share of responsibility, and there are some, you know, real notorious irresponsible actors like the Wall Street Journal editorial page that's been really terrible on this for many years. But the truth is that the problem is deeper than that, and I don't think it's fair to completely blame it on the media. We have a timescale problem. Climate change is a problem that has a timescale of decades to centuries. Its effects are real, it's happening now, and it's affecting us now. But the timescale over which we can change it is unfortunately much longer than that, because there's just enormous momentum in the Earth system. And so the problem is, what we're asking people to do is to pay the costs for a clean energy transformation today, which is wonderful in all sorts of ways, but make no mistake, it's still expensive. I think everybody understands that. And yet, the benefits are really going to be only accrued over many decades. We're talking about not just our children, but really our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and beyond. That's a tough sell if you ask people to spend money today to help their grandchildren. I think it's an essential thing we need to do, not just for our society, but also for the natural world. But a lot of people are hesitant to do that.
You know, I think that's a great point. That it is. It's like the old line about the politicians: "We don't want to fix anything now because I'm not going to get the credit for it while I'm still in office. I want to be able to beat people with that." But the other thing is, I mean, Jim hit on the political problem, and as you know as well as anybody, Professor Schrag, you get in a conversation, you go out to dinner or whether you're in your classroom or anywhere else, and you can say it's not the much media's problem, but I mean, it's not just the Wall Street Journal, it's Fox News, which is an incredibly powerful...
Excuse me, and CNN the other night.
Yeah, okay, it's an incredibly powerful news channel that a lot of people will tell you this is ridiculous. This is all a bunch of the, you know...
Cyclical.
It's cyclical or it's not even... I mean, some people will argue it's not even that big of a deal.
Yeah,
you know what
well,
I mean?
You know, yeah, I think, as somebody who studies the history of climate in the past, climate variations in Earth history have occurred. They are cyclical, but they only tell you that, in fact, what's happening today is even scarier than you might otherwise think, and is actually a very, very big deal. What we're doing today is geologically significant, and it's huge. So the science, ironically, leads to the exact opposite conclusion. I think in terms of the portrayal in the media and the misportrayal, it gets into a deeper discussion, not just of the responsibility of the media, but really of the role of money in politics in our society today. I mean, I think you can really question with recent Supreme Court decisions about campaign finance reform and the role of money that we're really have our democracy is facing a huge challenge. There was a statistic I read that said something like 150 individuals were responsible for 60% of the super PAC money in the last presidential election. That's crazy in a democracy of 300 million people. I mean, that's really
you got it right the first time. A democracy of 300 people, Dan Schreck. You know, Dan, I'm not at all the last person to belittle the impact of Citizens United and decisions like that. I want to go back to the earlier point you made because it's one that I have echoed on a whole spate of things, and I want to know how you feel we deal with this. Politicians do make a calculation. You said it. Marjorie said it afterwards. Should I fix the pension? Should I fix Social Security? Well, the calculation I'm making, whether it's subliminal or not, is it going to fall apart while I'm still a member of Congress? If it's not, let the next generation deal with it. You're talking about something far further into the future. So how do you make the sell except as an intellectual proposition to politicians who are worried about tomorrow, not 1,000 or 1,000,000 tomorrows, that they have to do something? How do you make that sell?
Well, I think there are a number of ways to do it, and one of the ways that I think is most important is actually to focus on the fact that we are seeing extreme weather today that are outside the realm of our experience. The drought of 2012, the heat waves a year and a half ago in March, Hurricane Sandy, a variety of things like that people feel intuitively are extraordinary. And there's a discussion that's happening in this country, really for the first time in my lifetime, around climate preparedness, on dealing with things about robustness and resilience, and how do we actually make sure that we can withstand some of these disasters.
Is that because of things like Sandy and Katrina, real-world experiences? Is that where that's coming from?
I think it is, and I think it's also the growing realization. Remember, the majority of people in this country are concerned about climate change. They're much more concerned about jobs and about the economy and about healthcare. But I think that doesn't mean they're not concerned about climate change. I think they are, and I think there's a growing awareness that this is a real issue. I'll tell you the other part that, to me, is very salient, which is who's going to really pay the costs? You know, after Hurricane Sandy, Congress almost didn't approve that big,
huge allocation. That's right.
And I actually think we're a handful of disasters away from Congress saying, you know what, we can't afford this anymore. We can't afford a $50 or $100 billion bailout of another U.S. city after it gets destroyed from some weather-related disaster. We just can't afford it anymore. And when that happens, I think we'll see a lot of behaviors changing.
Well,
the other thing,
sorry,
the other part that's really critical in all of this is the role of insurance. Ultimately, remember, insurance doesn't create this risk, but they buy and sell the risk. And ultimately, you know, insurance companies are more and more saying, we need to raise our rates because the risks are too high. That's going to affect people's pocketbooks, and that will change behavior. That will change the way people actually protect their homes and protect their communities.
We're talking to Dan Schreck, who's a professor of geology and the director of Harvard University's Center for the Environment. Can we bring this back to the United States? We talked about climate inequities, the U.S., China versus the Philippines, sub-Saharan Africa. How about within our own borders, Dan Schreck? We see similar sort of inequities in inner cities and those sort of things, don't we?
This is absolutely one of the most difficult challenges we face, is this question of when you talk about preparedness and adapting and thinking about how to get people ready for climate change, what to do about really poor communities. You know, there are, for example, very wealthy people who have houses on barrier islands along the Carolinas, along the New York coast, or along the Massachusetts coast. Wealthy homes that frankly, if they have to move them because they're getting inundated or they're getting hit by storms, so they move their houses. They might lose a little money, but these are wealthy people, and they'll deal with it. It's really the question of, you know, post-Katrina, poor people who had nothing left, or after Sandy, there were poor people who literally, with the new building standards, couldn't rebuild. They couldn't afford to rebuild. They lost everything. And you see this along the Massachusetts coast even. If you go down to Scituate, there are houses lining those barrier beaches that are just waiting to be knocked down by storms. Ultimately, those people have to move. And as sea level rises, as climate change continues, we're going to lose those homes. And yet, many of those people, you know, 90% of the value of their entire savings is in their home. So what do you do about this as a society? I don't think we have an easy answer for that.
Well, there's also the whole issue of if many people that live in the inner cities are enduring most of the pollution in those inner cities, too, with the industries there and that are just dirtying up the air. I mean, that's a whole other issue as well.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, the whole environmental challenges, it's an area we call environmental justice, but it's really a very big challenge. The plight of low-income communities across the United States with respect to the environment is a fascinating question in terms of their health, in terms of the food they have access to, but also their buildings. When you think about it, you know, energy efficiency, for example, of buildings. You know, if my windows leak, I can afford an extra $10 or $20 a month. It doesn't affect me very much. But for low-income people who are struggling to put healthy food on the table for their children, an extra $10 or $20 a month actually makes a really big difference in their lives. And therefore, some of these issues like energy efficiency are even more important for them than they are for us.
Well, there was a great line in one of the stories I read this morning in anticipation of talking to you about people. And of course, obviously, it makes so much sense. If you can't afford your air conditioning in the summertime when it gets really hot because you're on such a fixed income. You know what I wonder, Professor, though? Should people – we have this debate in Massachusetts all the time, Scituate, you just mentioned, about people rebuilding their homes there or trying to hold on to those homes, or after Sandy, some of the people along the New Jersey coast. Should we be rebuilding these places, or should we at this point, even in 2013, just throw up our hands and say it's pointless?
So, in many cases, I have for a long time advocated moving people and not letting people rebuild. We've done this historically along floodplains in the U.S., and, you know, after Katrina, there was a real debate about whether to rebuild New Orleans.
Right.
What are we doing spending, you know, nearly $100 billion rebuilding a city below sea level that's just going to get flooded again? That seems crazy. It just seems like a colossal waste of money. And yet, there's this very powerful claim to people who have lived their whole lives for many generations in New Orleans. There's a culture, there's a society there, and to make those people up and move seems horrible. And there's very compelling arguments on both sides. That's the challenge. You know, I don't think we have an easy answer here. Ultimately, I can promise you that the climate system's going to win. The Earth system is so powerful that sea level rise is going to continue for many centuries. And I don't know whether it's going to be in 10 years or in 50 years or in 100 years, but all those homes are going to be gone.
We're all going to be
eventually.
Living in Kansas. Hey,
so they'll have to move. It's just a question of will they move after a big storm, after a disaster that completely destroys their homes, or how much will we anticipate that with our investment?
You know, Dan Schrag, I'm thinking from a Harvard professor of geology and director of Harvard's Center for the Environment. I'm thinking back to what you said about the influence of money and that sort of thing. If you could administer sodium pentothal to those members of Congress and to those members of the scientific community who are denying what you suggest is going on and the vast majority of scientists suggest are going on, would we find out that they really believe it or that their opinions are being bought by those in whose interest it is not to have them believe it? Do you know what I mean? Do they really believe these arguments?
You mean a truth serum. You don't mean injecting them with anything sort of poison, right?
You're talking about... did I say poison? Well, that's actually my second thought.
Yeah,
I meant a truth serum.
Right, okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. That's all. So if you could sort of, you know, eavesdrop in their deepest feelings and actually figure out what they're really thinking, I think you'd see a range. I think one of the powers of money, and many, many psychological studies have showed this, is that there's an unconscious shaping of your views. I think the other part, though, is that unfortunately in this country, and it's not so true in Europe, by the way, both the conservatives and the labor parties in Europe, in many different countries, both believe in climate change. They think it's a serious problem. They have different strategies for how to deal with it, but they both think it's a real problem. In our country, somehow or other, the climate issue has been framed to one that can only be solved with big government, can only be solved with regulations that are anti-business, and therefore it's become ideological. People who are genuinely believe in reduced government and a free market think that somehow if they believe in climate change, they're sacrificing all of their other beliefs. And I think, therefore, linking it to these other things has been a terrible mistake in this country.
So isn't part of the solution, I hate to be as simplistic as I often am, is for people like you to convince the people we're just speaking about that it's in the economic interest of big money to solve this problem, that there's a lot of money to be made, there are tons of jobs to be created, there's great news for stockholders. Isn't that really part of the ticket here?
I do think that's part of the ticket, but I think it's not so simple because a lot of the biggest industries in the world are actually the ones that have the most to lose here.
Right.
And so there's, you know, the truth is if you ask a lot of big companies, do they care about climate change? Yeah, but it's, you know, not even on the top 20 things that their company really cares about. Whereas if you talk to the energy industry, the oil and gas and coal companies, they really care about this. But there's some twists in this, and this is where I think actually a slightly more strategic approach to this issue is needed. For example, the likely impact of regulations that are being proposed by the EPA on greenhouse gases, the likely impact is going to be very bad for coal, but extremely good for natural gas. Because in the short run, the only thing that's going to fill in to replace the coal plants that we shut down will be more use of natural gas. That's very good for the natural gas industry. So ironically, in the short term, the natural gas industry, and the largest producer, by the way, is ExxonMobil, they're going to be the biggest beneficiaries of climate policy. So the irony is actually that ExxonMobil is the big winner of climate policy. So now they ideologically are, of course, opposed to environmental regulation of any kind. But the irony is this particular time, they're going to make a lot of money from it.
Wow, we should have all bought Exxon stock while the getting,
good. I think we have to be using this kind of political irony to actually navigate our way in these early stages.
Can I ask you just one last question here? I just want to be clear, because you are an expert in this and I am not. The consensus is clear now that our activity as human beings is causing this climate change, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Is there anybody respected that is arguing against this now in the scientific community?
And this relates back to the previous question about what the truth serum would be.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are some people who are serious scientists who are genuinely skeptical.
Uh-huh.
And frankly, a lot of them are skeptical by nature because they should be. That's what scientists do. I think some of them are not aware of some of the broad range of evidence that's available here. Some people say, for example, this is just about models. And the truth is, our understanding of the climate system is not just based on models. We have lots and lots of observations, lots of data from the modern climate system, data from the past. So this is a very powerful set of observations and theory that ultimately leads to this conclusion. But I think there are a handful, but a very tiny number of people who have legitimate questions. On the other side, I think we have to remember that there's a lot of uncertainty. The Earth system is really complicated, and our models are not perfect at predicting the future. That doesn't mean climate change isn't happening. That doesn't mean we can breathe a sigh of relief. In fact, to me, it actually means the opposite. The uncertainty, to me, is likely to be worse than we expect. And so, but we have to be humble about what we don't understand, and we have to remind people that our predictions are not perfect, and they're going to be surprises. Unfortunately, I fear that many of the surprises we experience in the future are going to be very dangerous to us.
Hey, Dan Schrag,
okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
That was an upbeat ending. Thank you very
Sorry
much.
About that.
Oh, that's okay. It was great to talk to you. That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Professor Schrag. He's a professor of geology at Harvard University and also the director of Harvard University's Center for the Environment. Dan Schrag, thank you for joining us.
So you heard Dan Schrag mention coastal Massachusetts. You've also heard, I'm sure, in the last couple of days about this new FEMA flood map, which puts about 20,000 residences in danger. That's up from about 8,000. And it puts a number of businesses at risk, obviously, of flooding. It balloons from 250 to nearly 4,000, which means a huge spike in insurance premiums. So here's the question for you at 877-301-8970. Does hearing about these risks and the costs in the face of climate change and rising sea levels have you rethinking where you'll live and how you will live? 877-301-8970. I'm so glad you brought up the point about should we basically give in to nature. We talked to that guy from North Carolina a couple of weeks ago, whose name escapes me at the moment, who had wrote that terrific piece. I've mentioned the fact that the head of the Department of Environmental Protection in Massachusetts has said, is it Plum Island? We're always confused. It's ultimately, you can put up all the barriers you want. At some point, the ocean's going to win. And I have to say, this FEMA thing, which came out of nowhere last week, FEMA's new flood map reaches deep into city, was the headline. It was sobering for me. I mean, I don't live in Boston, but I travel in many of these neighborhoods and areas. There's this picture of the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Art, that is right there. I mean, that's no surprise because it's right on the water. But far in this reaches is amazing.
Well, we've just developed a lot of the South Boston waterfront, and that whole section there where Legal Seafoods is and where the ICA is, it's only a few feet above the water. And all those restaurants down there, they're in this whole new flood map. East Boston, where there's a lot of new immigrants. It's not exactly a wealthy community. One of the city's poorest, in fact. They're in the middle of the flood zone. You know, the issue is if the insurance companies come out and really jump up everybody's insurance rates, how will people be able to cover these new insurance costs? Because flood insurance is pretty expensive.
So you will – essentially, when you see these kinds of things, even if this Boston FEMA map, flood map, doesn't touch you, are things like this going to cause you to change the way you live and where you live, or do you just tough it out? And I have to say, you know, I'm sure you've seen these tornado aftermath photographs from the plains the last couple of days.
Horrible.
And you not only see interviews with people who just finished paying off or building their house a week before the tornado came, and you know what their response to the reporter is? We're going to rebuild. We're just going to be here, meaning we're never going to give up. But it's a legitimate question. At the same time that we're attempting to deal with climate change, I would say quite feebly, in this interim period, are people going to rethink how they live and where they live? 877-301-8970. Let's take Mike in Needham. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
With your scientist recently, just on, he wants to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from the United States. The number one cause of greenhouse gas emissions from the United States are people. I think they call it anthropomorphic. Immigration increases the population of people in the United States. Why is it? I haven't heard any environmentalists saying we have to reduce immigration into this country so we can reduce the greenhouse gases.
And I'm guessing you probably want what you do here, Mike, and I know that's what everybody – and why don't you add cows to the mix? Should we execute all the cows in America and become vegetarians? We don't have to worry about their CO2 production. The reality is something we can control easily if we had the will to control it is what comes out of those things that we manufacture. And the vast majority of the American people, despite that, what they say to pollsters, and the vast majority of major corporations don't have it in their self-interest. So we don't do it. So is your view, your solution is essentially close the borders?
It's just the figures. I mean, if you believe in mathematics, and I do, if you increase the population of the United States by 30 million people, which Democrats want to do, there will be more greenhouse gas emissions coming out from the United States.
I'm not following you here. How is that going to happen? Because of
Accept that it does happen. So let's assume that those 30 million people, 20 million of them, Mike, to take your thing to its natural next step, let's assume they stay south of the border, for example. So does that solve the problem? Assuming everything you say is correct, and I don't accept it, but let's assume you do. How does that solve the problem?
Well, first of all, you have to accept it because you have to accept mathematics. It's just plain math.
No, but Mike, let's face it. Your argument is an anti-immigration argument. It's not a fixed climate change argument. Isn't that where you're coming from?
No. What I am saying is that if you want to reduce
No, we know. You said it. You said it several times. We got it. We hear you. And you're right. Virtually nobody is discussing that ending immigration would be a solution to our problem. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Worcester, where Dan is on the phone. Dan, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, oop, we lost you. Sorry. Jack, you are in Haverhill. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jack.
Hey, how you folks doing today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Great. I mean, you know, if you look at this, you know, logically, I'm a very simple person, and my wife is too. And we're inland in Derry, New Hampshire. I love the ocean. I don't think I'd want to build there based on all the scientific data that's coming in talking about what could happen. But if you look at the folks that are well off and they can rebuild and they're willing to take that responsibility or that risk, God bless them. But I think for the rest of us, you know, it's just sense, common sense.
I think you said it perfectly. The reality is those who can afford to build the kinds of structures on pylons or whatever it is that can hopefully withstand this can, and the rest have got to make some decisions. And by the way, is there anything that's more alluring than living on the ocean? But you're right, that you're taking a risk that is colossal. Jack, thanks for the call.
Mark just emailed in and said, the only comfort I can take in the climate change discussion is that my house, which is about 1,200 feet back from the ocean, will sometime soon have an ocean view.
I know. You can live in Kansas and have an ocean view, too. These numbers, this FEMA thing, which inside the changes are not, they are fairly imminent. They're a couple of years away. There have to be hearings held on these kinds of things. But the insurance premiums, beyond the actual risk, the insurance changes are colossal. And as you said, if you are of a certain level of means, they're totally unaffordable.
Well, you know, this piece in the Globe has a picture of the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Art, which is built like 5 feet above the water. It's only been there for a few years. I think when was it built? In 2005, 2006, something like that?
2006.
I don't think we do this again in 2013. I don't think you build it that way because you're hoping it's going to last for a century, aren't you? And I don't think you put it there. And I think that's one of the issues is you're going to be thinking about doing things differently for development reasons. There's all this talk now about having all the electrical systems and all the wiring and everything on top of buildings instead of down at the bottom of buildings. And when we say that there's not an immediate sense of concern about this, again, I think this is another issue where young people are much more concerned. If you have 20-somethings living down in New York, and after Hurricane Sandy, they could not go back to sections of Brooklyn. I mean, never mind, you know, down by the World Trade Center.
Yeah, but those young people are going to—they're going to grow up to be politicians. And the point that I made, that Dan Schrag made, and that you made is true. If you can put it off, you put it off, and you particularly put it off when you can't afford current needs. I mean, that's the what I think I said to him at the end. Not that I am. I'm playing Marjorie again. Not that I'm an expert in this.
We're not experts,
area.
Jim. Neither of us.
There has got to be an economic self-interest incentive for major corporations that decide to change their behavior. It's that simple. Viziana, you're in Charlestown. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
My point about this is I definitely would choose where I would live. And the map that they did about the Boston area is something that I've been dreaming about a long time ago since climate change started to really affect us as this catastrophe happened. But the thing is, I think that this should be be done in a bigger scale. So you could give the people the option to stay or to leave before a hurricane hits or whatever happened.
Why assume FEMA is doing this? I'm guessing that they're doing this everywhere. I'm embarrassed to say I don't know, but I'm assuming that these federal maps,
well,
and the one we're talking about is Boston.
That's
focused.
Part of the reason is to plan for big storms, is to figure out how you're going to get out, who should get out, all that kind of stuff before it happens, and also obviously for insurance purposes and development purposes. How
Viziani,
is Charlestown?
Thank you. Oh,
how's
sorry.
Charlestown? Is that's pretty close to sea level, isn't it, or is it?
Viziana, you still there?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
You. Bye-bye.
Oh, I'm sorry. We had a little confusion on our part there. Thank you for the call. See, my sense is, and this is not based on surveys, it's based on my sense of human nature, the risk of flood damage to the average person in, let's say, eastern Massachusetts will be less of an incentive to move than the economic, the immediate economic cost, which is the insurance thing. That's my sense. Everybody's betting against disaster, don't you think? When I interviewed a ton of the people who suffered horrible damage from Plum Island, and while I remember one family, I wish I could remember their name, talked about how they had moved their elderly father who lived with them out to California where they had a second house. Obviously, they're fairly wealthy. They were staying. They were rebuilding, doing whatever they had to do. They were staying the course. And I know almost nobody in that neck of the woods who was contemplating leaving.
But the issue again becomes, like you say, economic, because a lot of the people that were flooded out in Hurricane Sandy can't afford to rebuild.
Have you seen some? By the way, this is a year after. Have you seen some of the video of what people, including that
horrible
family who the president hugged a year ago and said, "I will not." And I'm blaming Obama for this. He's got a lot on his plate. The president said, "I will not forget you." CNN interviewed them a year after, and it's just they are living like in boxes. Natalie, you're on the highway somewhere. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Natalie.
Hi, actually, it's Metalise. I am a realtor in Rhode Island, and, you know, we've been dealing with these new flood maps for about a month and a half now, and they have really impacted the decisions of home buyers on where they're going to purchase
really?
A house. Yes, and there's a couple of different scenarios. So if you can purchase the house outright and you can pay cash for it, then the bank's not going to require you to have flood insurance. So immediately you limit certain people who can purchase those houses.
Great point.
They don't have enough. Right. So, but even people with cash, because I had some home buyers that were purchasing with cash, and we looked at a couple of houses, they chose not to purchase one of the houses because it was in the new flood zone. And, you know, their rate could have been as high as like $10,000 or $20,000 a year.
As compared, Natalie, to what was it 5 years ago? What was that rate?
You know, we may be talking $800 or $1,000 a year for flood insurance.
So it's as much as a tenfold increase.
Yeah, there's a very small house in Rhode Island that was owned outright. The guy refinanced it. The house is in the new flood zone. His annual insurance rate is $66,000 with a cap of $250,000 max for what he can get if the house is destroyed.
Wait a minute.
Insurance for a maximum return of four times that much?
Yes.
Hold on. How close to the house is the house to the water, and what's the house worth?
It's pretty close. This particular house is not worth that much, but we're seeing it all over the place. You know, I have buyers that they will not purchase a house in the flood zone, not because they're afraid it's going to get wiped out, but if they ever want to go sell it, somebody else may not want to purchase it because of the high cost of the flood insurance.
Hey, Natalie, that was really an informative, important call. Thank you for sharing that with us. By the way, if you're concerned about where you fall in this whole spectrum here, if you go to floodsmart.gov, you can look at the FEMA maps and figure out what your area looks like. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
I'm afraid to go look at the FEMA maps.
I know. Well, you literally have been talking about this, the house you and your sister have on the Cape.
And we're not that close to the water either, but you worry that the Cape itself is just that little small peninsula sticking out into the ocean.
Believe me.
And people, the joke down, you know, and the outer edges of the Cape, you know, down Truro and Wellfleet and stuff, is that the people that bought the house 2 miles from the ocean are now like a mile and a half, and pretty soon they're going to be a mile, and pretty soon they're going to be in the ocean.
Well, you know, by the way, but it's not a joke.
It's not a joke.
And again, I don't have the data in front of me. When I interviewed these Plum Island people, and everybody was interviewing them, not just me, they would tell stories about how far their house was from the water when they bought the house 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's like a science fiction movie. Let's squeeze one more in. John, you're also in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yes.
Well, I just called with a couple of comments. First, I want to I disagree with the fact that climate change in and of itself is necessarily bad. It may be bad from in the context of people who don't like change. I kind of view it as being inevitable, and you know, you're fighting the inevitable. So I say let's have policies that adapt to it rather than are fearful and try and reverse something that I perceive as inevitable.
Well, by the way, and I would say you can do both. You don't have to accept it as inevitable, but you can be a realist and be planning at the same time that you're trying to fight back. But go ahead, John. What's your second point?
The second point is that I do think that as a homeowner and taxpayer, I moved to Rhode Island a year ago, and I bought a house that's at 243 feet above sea level. I'm partly because I don't want to have flood exposures, and I don't want to have my investment in my property lost due to the climate change. And so I plan for it. And ultimately, I think the onus is on the individuals who are buying the houses. I didn't force people to live in New Orleans. I don't see why I should be expected to bail them out repeatedly when a place that's below sea level floods.
Well, you subscribe, and John, we hear you. Thanks for the call. That was the point that Marjorie raised
but
with Dan Trang just a few minutes
in
ago.
In fairness, when many of these people, when millions of these people bought their houses, we were not talking
totally
about
right.
climate change. So it's one thing in 2013 to say go in with your eyes open. I mean, even this is not something that certainly in the 50s or 60s or even 70s people were thinking about.
But people
often.
Are going with their eyes open now.
Did you hear
that? That Natalie phone call, that real estate broker from Rhode Island, was pretty stunning, actually.
Yeah, okay. When we come back, we're going to look at one demographic who Pope Francis has failed to include in his wide embrace. We're going to talk about that up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Rowdy. She is Marjorie Egan. A presidential election happened earlier this week right here in the United States. On Tuesday, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz from Louisville, Kentucky, was elected president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Joining us to talk about who he is, what kind of authority the Conference of Catholic Bishops has with Pope Francis at the helm, is Michelle Dillon. As you know, Michelle is professor of sociology and department chair at the University of New Hampshire. Michelle, it's good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Marjorie.
We'll get back to the bishop thing in just a second, the election there. But I just want to ask you, you know, a lot of center and left of center Catholics, whether they're still practicing Catholics or not, have been swooning over Pope Francis. But a lot of conservative Catholics are very, very upset. What's their problem?
Well, I think largely the problem is that, you know, for many decades now, many Catholics, and in particular the Catholic bishops, and, of course, the previous popes have made abortion really the number one moral issue confronting Catholics, both not only as a personal moral issue, but also in terms of political engagement. And so I think when Francis said that the Church has been too obsessed with abortion, among other issues, including gay sexuality, that took a lot of Catholics, regardless of their own leanings on the issue, it took a lot of them by surprise, because it really has been the most consistently pushed issue by the Vatican and by, in particular, the American Catholic bishops, really since Roe v. Wade.
But, you know, there's going to be, in my guess, and you correct me if I'm wrong, the Church is never going to change on abortion. It may change on divorce and remarried Catholics. It may change on ordination of women or even married priests. Abortion is never going to change. I don't get why they're so upset, you know.
Yes. Well, of course, yes, the Church teaching on abortion is not going to change, but many Catholics, particularly conservative Catholics, and not just conservative Catholics, because even moderate Catholics who would be pro-choice themselves, nonetheless tell us all the time in our research that they actually appreciate the Church's outspokenness on the abortion issue, that it is a more complicated issue than simply just being another sort of policy-type issue. Yes, so the bishops or Church teaching is not going to change, but I think it's perception that it doesn't demand the same moral fervor among the faithful in terms of opposing abortion than was assumed to be the case, probably has certainly stopped some of the advocates of the pro-life movement, taking them aback a bit.
You know, speaking of it won't change, what actually has changed? You know, Marjorie mentioned that the Catholics on the left and disenfranchised or disengaged Catholics are thrilled. I have to say there's a non-Catholic you're talking to, me, who's been thrilled by Pope Francis. But other than tone and style, what actually has changed since Pope Francis has taken over?
Well, nothing has changed in terms of moral or doctrinal teaching, but as you mentioned, you know, tone and symbolism matters. And basically, Francis, since day one when he became Pope and came out sort of very humbly asking people to pray for him and speaking in very sort of personal terms, has said, you know, the Church really is the people of God. It's not simply the hierarchy. And his own modest style of living, as was well documented in the media, living in the guest house at the Vatican rather than in the papal apartment, which are much more regal, This is sending a very clear message to people that this really is the church of the poor and of social justice, and that Catholics, regardless of their political leanings, need to pay more attention to living the message of Jesus rather than getting focused either on cultural war issues or, you know, getting too wound up even in other sort of nitty-gritty doctrinal matters.
You know, Michelle, Dylan, I don't know if I asked you this question. My apologies if I did. Ray Flynn, the former mayor of Boston, former ambassador to the Vatican from the U.S., was with us right around a couple of times, right around the election. And he knows Pope Francis and thinks personally, and he thinks the world of him, and apparently always has. And Ray Flynn is always talking about poor people, said it was the most important issue facing Boston, the inequities in society here. What I asked him was, if the Cardinals had another shot to vote on Pope and they knew then what they know now about Pope Francis, would he have been elevated?
Well, you know, of course, that's a hypothetical question.
Oh, of course.
You know, but my own view on this would be that, yes, they would. I mean, I think, and I've always said this, you know, prior to the election of who the new Pope's going to be, people would say, well, who do you not want it to be, or who do you want it to be? And quite sincerely, my answer always was, I don't really mind who it is, because no matter who's elected, they do bring in a new breath of air. Now, some bring fresher air than others, for sure. But I think, you know, any new Pope would bring the faithful and the cardinals and other bishops along with him. So certainly some might have second thoughts and have reservations, but I think ultimately all of these cardinals and bishops believe as Catholics in the power of the Holy Spirit in terms of moving the church in a particular direction. And I think they have to, you know, sort of bite their tongue, if you like, and say, I may not exactly like what I'm hearing from the Pope on every time he makes a speech, but nonetheless, this must be the way forward for the church. They really do need to do something to move out of our current sort of morass, if you like, and maybe he really is the person to do it. So I don't think, that people say, oh my goodness, what are we going to do with this guy?
We're talking with Professor Michelle Dillon from the University of New Hampshire. Michelle, we're all supposed to be getting this survey, Catholics are, about what we think from the Pope, what we think about stuff like gay marriage and divorce and birth control and the so-called hot-button issues. How significant is this? I mean, is he going to sit back in his guest apartment there and go through the responses? And
Well, I think, I mean, of course, I wish he'd read our book, because that'll tell him a lot of what American Catholics think about a lot of these issues.
That's a great point.
So I do think it's a really significant move. I mean, prior to any synod, in principle at least, the Pope is supposed to sound out through the various bishops, to sound out, you know, what are the needs, what are the pastoral needs in their own particular diocese. But this, obviously, this initiative seems to me to be unprecedented. And, of course, not only is it unprecedented in this large-scale survey approach that is being taken, but also the actual issues, that it's not simply about the prayer life of Catholics or about certain points of theology, even though, of course, there is some relevance to that. But it's really asking where are Catholics in their lives today? And how are they dealing with these very pressing issues got to do with divorce and its consequences, gay marriage, etc.? So, again, it doesn't mean that the Church is going to change any teaching, but at least it shows its awareness that the modern world is changing and that it as a church needs to be aware and needs to be accommodating and more accommodating of some of these pressing pastoral needs.
You know, there's been a perception, a joke, if you will, that the American bishops in recent years prior to Pope Francis have all joined the Republican Party. You know, they've been very much down with Republican candidates and crusading endlessly against Obamacare and stuff like that. The bishops met again this week or last week. Was it this week?
12th.
Was this week?
It was November.
Last week, excuse me.
Yes,
And Dolan, the archbishop from New York City, who'd been sort of a culture warrior and all this stuff, is gone. And we have a new gentleman, this Archbishop Kurtz. What's the significance of his election to be the head
the election itself is a routine event, but yes, of course, you know, Cardinal Dolan got the election, you know, 3 years ago, and in fact it was somewhat of a surprise because the person who was in line, who was then the vice president of the Catholic Conference of Bishops, was Bishop Kakanis from Tucson, Arizona. And it was expected that usually that the vice president becomes the president. And in fact, he did not get enough votes. And that was seen at the time that Bishop Kakanis is seen as a very pastoral person. He doesn't get into these cultural war discussions. And that is sort of seen, in a sense, as a slap in the face, if you like, not only to him personally, but sort of the more moderate liberal end of American Catholicism. And the elevation of Cardinal Dolan was seen that, you know, this is going to be, you know, a new boisterous, aggressive leader moving the church forward, because, you know, it's only really in the last 3 or 4 years that the Catholic bishops in America have become, you know, have become bold again in their public voice, because I think that the fallout from the sex abuse crisis seemed, in my mind at least, to have silenced them a little bit. I mean, they were still involved in activism, but not at the same public intensity as they have been for the last 3 years. And certainly Cardinal Dolan was seen as the person best suited to be their leader in that sort of public aggressive mode. So the shift, which is a routine shift, but now it seems by all accounts that the current president and the vice president are much more pastoral, much more quiet in their perspective, and it would seem that they're very much in keeping with Pope Francis's emphasis on the focus on social justice and poverty and, you know, helping our neighbor in need, whether it's the immigrant or whoever it is.
Even though Bishop Kurtz was the leader, was the bishop's leader, was he not on the fight against gay marriage in this country?
Well, of course, all of them are by definition, so, you know, but it's the extent to which one is more vociferous in those fights or debates as opposed to others. So yes.
You've mentioned the culture wars a couple of times. There have been some pieces locally about our own cardinal, Sean O'Malley, and there's a Globe story written by Lisa Wangsness from Baltimore, right in the heart of the meeting, the annual gathering of U.S. bishops. And he says, sounding exactly like, I was going to say his boss, like my apologies, about like Pope Francis says, church is often seen as more engaged in culture war issues such as abortion and gay marriage, and it must be corrected, more focus on the poor. And while you mentioned a minute ago, Michelle, how bold the bishops have become, it seems to me that they're all falling into line. I mean, this is the same Cardinal O'Malley who stopped all adoptions rather than have gay couples adopt kids, including stopping heterosexual adoptions through the Catholic Church. This is the guy who boycotted the Irish prime minister's speech at BC because the Irish prime minister had the temerity to support an abortion change, which would have protected the life of the mother. So are they falling into line because they have to, or are they falling into line because they believe Pope Francis has the right message for the church?
Well, I think sort of all of the above. I mean, I think in general, bishops do fall in line. It is supposed to be a college of bishops, so there is supposed to be an element of collegiality. So they fall in line with the head bishop, who of course is the Pope. But it's also, and this goes to Marjorie's earlier reference, you know, to all the American bishops becoming Republican. You see, I think the complexity of being Catholic is that, yes, it seems, and certainly the Catholic bishops, that they're siding with the Republicans when it comes to issues such as abortion or gay rights. But on the other hand, at the same time, they're equally committed to issues of economic equality and social justice. And, of course, they don't always give voice to those issues, partly because of the larger culture and the political issues of the day. So I think for many of the bishops, it's refreshing. And I would say especially for Cardinal O'Malley, who does himself, you know, emulates very much and has embodied the spirit of that Francis too has in terms of St. Francis and that helping the poor, that in a sense for them it's probably refreshing at some level that they don't have to keep talking every day about abortion and same-sex marriage, and that in line with even what they're feeling in their own hearts, that they can actually try to make a better life for the poor and the immigrants and, you know, just helping those sorts of issues. And so he's given them permission, or not just giving them permission, in the sense he's obliging them to, you know, get back on board with their focus on social justice, and I think many welcome this.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because every time as someone like you, Michelle Dillon, makes that point about the bishops, about the cardinals in this country, I think back, all people remember of Bernard Law in this part of the world is the utter disgrace of his leadership during this horrible time. Prior to that, the only thing I knew of Bernard Law, I was a former lobbyist at the State House, was seeing his eloquent, relentless testimony on poor people's issues on Beacon Hill. I mean, the guy was really as good as anybody was, and then obviously it all got erased by something far more serious.
And that's the complexity. It's also, of course, regrettable that sometimes certain issues derail for good reason some of the cardinals or bishops. But a lot of them are much more multidimensional than we see through the media or through sometimes some of the ways in which they end up getting publicity. So, but that really is the dilemma, if you like, or the challenge, whether for bishops or for ordinary Catholics, is that you really have to be, if you take Cardinal Bernardine, the late Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago, his emphasis on the commitment to the consistent ethic of life, and that required you to be pro-life from conception through death and throughout the life, so that not only were you anti-abortion, but you were pro-helping the poor, helping teenage mothers, helping those who needed welfare and health assistance during their lives, and of course, right up, you're also opposed to the death penalty. So, as we know in the political world, people tend to be, you know, pro-life, and like Democrats tend to favor social welfare and healthcare, but be more in line to be pro-choice in terms of the law on abortion, whereas Republicans are the opposite; they're anti-choice and abortion, but also anti-helping the poor and the hungry, etc.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, and maybe we just haven't paid enough attention to these and missed them in the media, Michelle Dillon. But if the bishops are going to reorient themselves in the United States to issues involving the poor, they've been awfully silent about the millions that have been left out of any kind of Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, in these different states that won't expand Medicaid. They've been awfully silent still about immigration. They've been awfully silent about the Republicans wanting to cut food stamps. So I don't see that they're turning their words yet into action unless they're just thinking about their action.
Well, in fairness to the bishops, I mean, some have been speaking out over the last few years, indeed, and Cardinal Mahoney, until he lost his credibility a few months ago or so, was one of the key figures in terms of pro-immigration reform. And they have spoken a little bit, but no, you're absolutely right. They haven't had the same consistency of voice when it comes to the poor. And I think a lot of Catholics would hope now, particularly given Pope Francis and his leadership, that that will change. And, for example, the current debates over farm bills and healthcare and all of this will allow them and push them to come out and really be to the forefront in making the case that, you know, who is my neighbor? The answer to that is pretty clear, and you don't have to look too far afield to see who is in need.
One last thing from me, Michelle Dillon, about Cardinal O'Malley. There's a Lisa Wang, that's also in the Globe, quotes Amy Sullivan, who writes in the National Journal magazine, referring to Cardinal O'Malley as the Pope's new BFF, best friend forever.
Yeah.
And apparently, not only are they close, and we understand he was the only American chosen for this group of eight who were Council of Eight Cardinals who were advising him on church governance things. Apparently, they talk on the cell phone. And what does it mean? What will the manifestation be, if any, of O'Malley's very close relationship with Pope Francis?
Well, you mean manifestation?
I mean, what happens as a result of, I mean, what happens here? What happens to him, meaning O'Malley? What's the consequence of this relationship?
I think they would be, birds of a similar feather in terms of where their heart lies in terms of caring, for the disadvantaged in society. And they're also very reflective and humble men. I don't think it's necessarily going to, you could ask, I think you've asked me this some months ago, what will his career be like?
Yeah.
I mean, he can only go, the next highest spot is, of course, to be a Pope himself, and maybe that's on the cards. But even if it's not after, Pope Francis dies, I don't think it's about career aspirations. It's about having a friend. I mean, it must be very gratifying for Cardinal O'Malley to know that he is, home all the way, and that to have this good relationship. So I think from the point of view of being a pastor to the world, it puts Cardinal O'Malley up there. He's not just the bishop of the Boston Archdiocese, but actually by being able to share his views and talk so intimately, I assume, with Pope Francis, that really can help, consolidate Pope Francis's own vision of what he wants to do with the church. So I think it must be mutually gratifying for both of them to have each other, to sound each other out on these issues.
Wouldn't you love to see their texts, Michelle Dillon?
I'm sure you'll be finding those first.
Yeah. Michelle Dillon, I have one last question before we go too. I wonder if you think if the church does keep along these lines, reemphasizing helping the poor, reemphasizing the social justice, getting off the hot button issues, will it make a difference? I mean, you've still got mostly elderly priests, because there's not that many going into the priesthood. I'm lucky enough to go to a Jesuit parish, but a lot of parishes, the sermons are not very good. The music is even worse. It's not exactly the Sunday Mass uplifting experience for those reasons. Will it make any difference in getting Americans back into the pews, do you think?
Well, I think it probably makes some difference because people are taking a second look at the Pope, and maybe it depends on what new pastoral initiative. So if there is a commitment to being more open to accommodating the needs of divorced and remarried Catholics or gay Catholics, then if that converts into reality, one would expect that more parishes will be every day be welcoming of what are currently sort of disaffected Catholics. So it may bring more back into the pews. But it's not a foregone conclusion by any means.
Yeah.
Because again, as Jim emphasized, it's a change in tone. But until there's real practical changes, in terms of what it means to be part of the Catholic Church in terms of, you know, women's ordination and some of these other issues, I think you're going to have a hard time convincing, especially the younger generation.
Michelle, it's great to talk to you, as always.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you, Michelle. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you both. Have a good day. Thank
you too. Michelle Dillon is a professor of sociology and department chair at the University of New Hampshire. When we come back, this is my favorite story of the day. We're going to ask you, how do you spend your lunch break? Do you take a lunch break? Are you among the power lunch elite, or do you make the dining al desco demography? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Most states mandate at least a half-hour break for lunch in an eight-hour workday. But how many of you actually take a lunch break? Do you do something as old school as getting, I don't know, one, two, three martini lunch? Are you among the many who, as Marjorie said, dine al desco, subjecting your keyboard to the daily snowfall of crumbs, the aroma in the workplace in search of free food in one of the break rooms? 65% of us. I am staggered by this number. 65% of us either eat lunch at their desk or eat no lunch at all. We want to know where you fall at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. You know, one of the great myths is, well, if I stay at my desk because I'm so busy, I have so much work to do, so much responsibility, I'm going to be more productive. All the surveys, all of the tests, yep, all of the comparative analysis says if you leave the workplace and have a relaxing, even 30 minutes sitting at a table, having a conversation with a friend, something, lunch outside the place where you actually work, you're going to return more productive, more creative. It is so, I'm not a scientist, it is so obvious to me, it is pathetic, but two out of three of us, Marjorie, do the lunch at the same place you spend the whole day.
Well, there are other downsides to this as well, Jim. Eating al desco makes you fat because you eat the wrong things. You're gorging on crisps and chocolate and Coke instead of having a proper lunch. It, as you said, it does not do what you think it does for your productivity. Also, it doesn't help your strong relationships with your colleagues because you could be going out with your colleagues that you like and gossiping at work. And it makes you more stressed. Plus, this is kind of the gross part. Crumbs and drippings linger on your computer, taking root in the crevices of your keyboard because you spill your food all over your lunch place. And apparently, desks are very unsanitary.
You want to hear? Well, I'll give you the hard data on that. I'm glad you brought that up. The typical desk, according to the Washington Post, has 100 times as much bacteria as the typical kitchen table. And that's the Washington Post quoting a study from the University of Arizona.
Yum, yum.
It is. In all seriousness, and I'll preempt, Marjorie brought this up yesterday when we thought we were going to discuss it with Brian McGorry, editor of the Globe, saying that I sit at my desk with a little Tupperware of things, and it is pathetic. And I do it because my schedule is such.
All wrapped.
I leave here, and I have to run
bands
to NECN. I have no choice. Now, Brian McGorry is of a different school. He's the editor of the Globe. He was with us yesterday. We asked Brian how often he eats lunch at his desk.
Nobody will ever go hoarse telling me not to drop crumbs on my desk.
Pretty good line, and it's pretty obvious. As he went on to say, his job is to go to Boston and something, learn
but
more
you know
about
what?
The city.
You know what the other thing is?
What's that?
It's the corporate culture in your workplace. I mean, if you are taking an hour for lunch, you're not really working very hard, are you? I mean, that's in many operations, that's part of the deal. But if you're eating at your lunch, you're a macho worker, you're too busy being productive for your bosses to, you know, walk a half an hour across the street or go to Safeway, wherever you want to go. Not Safeway. Safeway is the place you can get
Safeway is actually
what's the place? Subway.
Yeah.
To get the sub sandwiches, obviously.
Nothing quite as relaxing as going to Subway for a $5 foot long. No, I'm serious, by the way.
Well, that's the other thing. I think a lot of people think it's too expensive to go out for lunch.
Do you think most people in France, Marjorie, sit at their
no.
desk during lunch?
No.
I don't think so.
But the times I've been to France to visit my kid when she was over there, you go out to lunch and there are these dogs sitting next to you at the lunch table.
So what, is that a reason to eat at your desk?
No, I just thought it was fascinating. You know, you can bring your dog and they're sitting on the little chairs.
Okay,
it's really cute.
Okay, good. Let's start with George. You are in Marblehead. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Which side are you on here, George?
Jim and Marjorie. I have two favorite things to do.
Yeah.
My first favorite thing is sit down and relax and do a little meditation.
Oh.
My second favorite thing, and it could be my first sometimes, is listening to Jim and Marjorie while I'm having lunch in my car.
Okay. Well, don't change that. Don't change that, George. You get a special papal dispensation.
He doesn't need dispensation. That counts as leaving your work. You're not
outside the door.
That's great. And don't you feel, at the end of your listening to our discussions, such as they are here, don't you feel more relaxed, more productive, more creative,
here's
George?
Here's the thing. When I meditate, I do feel more relaxed. However, when I listen to you, Jim, I work myself into a lab every day, and I have to just call.
George, you're a good guy. Thanks for the call. Enjoy lunch. We appreciate it.
No, George. You're not the only one who gets worked into a lather. I think I've heard that once or twice.
Yeah,
I
should read some of the emails.
No,
can I tell you something? This is one of these things where I know you're going to get aggravated with me when I say this. Don't worry. I'm not suggesting a law that requires people to go out.
Okay.
I think employers should require, not allow.
Yeah.
If you have a deadline, if you have a project, it's got to be in at 3 o'clock or at 5 o'clock. That's one thing. On a normal day, a good employer should say, John, Jim, Marjorie, Jane, got to leave the office. You've got to physically leave this place for 30 to 60 minutes to recharge. It's ridiculous.
Okay.
I mean, it's totally right.
Jim will be writing up a piece of legislation soon.
No, you don't need
not
a law.
Yeah.
You need good employers. Alex, you're in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Alex.
Hey, how are you, Jim?
Great.
At my job, I actually, I'm an intern, but I'm a paid intern. And I actually have to eat while I work because I man their watching of the television. I work at a TV station, so I have to make sure that all the channels are on. I would manage like three of them at the same time, so I'm not required. I cannot leave my post.
So you never get a break, Alex?
I never get a break.
And how do you feel about eating? How do you feel about eating literally in the same place where you spend your whole workday? How's that?
It's extremely boring, but you know, I think it also goes with the people that you work with around you, because I'm very interactive with my coworkers, and I think that's what makes it a lot easier, that I could still talk and joke with my coworkers while I'm eating.
Yeah, well, I hate to admit this, but Alex makes a good point. If you're in a collegial kind of place where you're like thank you, Alex, for the call. Like the newsroom at WGBH, we're in these little pods. We're really next to virtually everybody who we work with, like, and talk to. That's a little bit different, but it's still not the same as sitting across from somebody at a table. Like on a beautiful day like today, you walk out in the sunshine, even though it's too cold. You walk across to a restaurant, you sit. It's a whole different thing. So Alex has an excuse because apparently he works for a tyrannical employer at some TV station.
He's also an abused intern. I mean, that happens a lot.
He doesn't sound abused, though, but he is.
You're just sitting there with the five or six. That was like the guy that used to have to sit there with the 19,000 police radios when we all had police radios at newspapers, and that's what your job was, to sit there all day long and monitor those. That's not easy, Jim.
Do you agree, and Sally, even before we discuss this, Alex, thanks for the call, do you agree that it is an unhealthy behavior eating at your desk?
No, I don't.
Why don't you agree with it?
Because I'd rather enjoy eating at my desk.
What is the part you enjoy? What is to enjoy? I mean,
I read
there's
my
nothing
stories,
to enjoy.
I eat my today. What was that stuff that we were eating? The stone ground, whatever it
oatmeal.
Was?
Oatmeal. We were both eating oatmeal.
the stone ground oatmeal. I was reveling because I melted some bananas in there. It was your suggestion, actually. And
suggestion.
I have to say it was delicious to melt the bananas in there. So I was reveling how delicious it was. I rather enjoy eating it at my desk.
I know this
the
is
crumbs,
hard to believe.
The crumbs, though, in the crevices of the computer
That's
are a problem.
Problem.
You know, they're in there and they're like festering. And before you know it, you have things growing in your computer.
Can I tell you something? This will shock you, but you might want to write this down.
Okay,
actually serve
that?
Oatmeal in restaurants. You know, you can go to a restaurant. Excuse me. Can I have a bowl of oatmeal with some melted banana on it? You could do that.
Yeah, but they're not going to get that at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Can I make another statement here? In all the research, none of the research mentions this point, but I will state it as a certainty. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, you live longer. You really do. If you take breaks,
then,
particularly at lunchtime.
Then why don't you do it?
Because I can't, because I have a television show that is live 4 hours after this is over.
Jim,
it's not my choice, even though I love
very
my jobs.
Important man.
I didn't say that. I wasn't saying, I knew you'd say
with
that. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying my work life is such.
Everybody else can take a break, but Jim is needed 24/7.
You know what I did? Yeah, I'm going to tell you the truth. Yesterday, it was one of my. Ate a chicken, a salad with chicken salad atop it. This is horrible. I really shouldn't admit this. As I was driving to NECN, And so essentially, I'd say a dollop, is that the proper word, of chicken salad was in my crotch, which is is unfortunate, but it's
leaving a lovely
little
stain
on my shirt, little on the floor. I mean, it is a perfect object lesson of how not to do things.
You know, I mean, like the President of the United States, Jim, you just can't hit the time to sit down and have a meal.
No, and I want to, it is not because of a feeling of self-importance. It's because my schedule is such that I can't do it. And
okay.
I miss that. What did I say to you this morning in the newsroom? Did I not say, as much as I love both my jobs, the only thing, in fact, I said it here a few minutes ago during the break, I miss the fact that I can't go, forget this.
You know, if you didn't spend so much time putting together seven Tupperware bins every morning with little elastics, you might have more time. Excuse me to go out to lunch. Let's
Eric
go
in
to
Providence, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how you guys doing? Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can. Thanks. What's up?
So I work at a nonprofit in Providence, and it's pretty old school. We have half an hour lunch and 2 15-minute breaks. And every now and then what I like to do is combine all three for 1 hour to go home and play with my dog.
Good for you. How often did you say you do that?
I do it once a week, I would say, you know, and it's awesome.
And Eric, when when you come back to work on the day when you've actually scheduled it in such a way that you can do the dog thing at home, don't you feel invigorated and really ready for action? Don't you feel a lot better?
Oh, yeah, of course. I feel like I'm like, oh, I want to stay home.
Yeah.
But I do come back. I eat lunch at my desk and keep working while I'm eating, but at least I had, you know, some time with the pup.
Well, that's a variation on a theme. Even though you're eating lunch at the desk, that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Eric, thanks for the call.
Well, they do have this one study out of the Department of Labor that talks about the percentage who do other things besides eating at restaurants or going out with their friends. Well, one of the things people do is go for a walk, and most of those who go for a walk are going home to walk their dog, so that presumes you live close enough to walk the dog. Some people are just spend their lunch hour surfing the internet or watching television or playing cards.
You know what I realized?
Anybody who plays cards.
I wasn't going to admit this to you, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Oh, they search for other jobs.
About 3 or 4 days, I guess it was last week, I decided that I needed a little bit of break, even though I had to go to NECN to do my live show at 6 o'clock. See, you know what I did?
What did you do?
No, you'd be proud of me to a point.
What?
It's sort of like Eric. I went home to walk the dog, and when I got there, you know what I realized?
You don't have a dog.
I don't have a dog. But the sentiment was totally there. Now, again, as I always say, with some trepidation, we will go to Dedham, where Sean would be on the phone. Hello there, Sean.
Jimmy, any chance you can go for a walk Monday through Friday from like 12 to 2? You know, just help us all out. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Sean.
Listen, Jimmy,
I'll take that under advisement.
Once you get some legislation, once you tax people who decide to keep their butts on the chair at work, I'm sure you'll be a fast upon working on that.
Actually, it's some.
Why don't you do lunch, Marjorie? When are we going to do lunch?
We should do lunch, Sean. That would be fun. That would be most fun. At 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock. We'll
let's
go someday
it,
at 2 o'clock.
Let's make it drinks on a Friday at about 7 o'clock some nice place in Boston. Just don't tell my wife.
Okay.
Sean, it's great to hear from you as always. Actually, that's the thought. Tax people.
You know, that's one of the great things about Mad Men.
Stay at their desk.
When
what's
you
it?
Watch that television show and the 2 and 3 martini lunches were still in vogue then, and you go, people will go out for these long lunches. How do they function?
Go out?
When
what are you talking
back
about?
To the office. Then, of course, halfway through the lunch, they decide, you know how it is. You have a couple of cocktails. Suddenly, everybody looks a little bit better. And then they work.
Do you really watch Mad Men?
Yes, I've watched Mad Men many times.
Forget lunch. Don Draper walks into his office, and as soon as his secretary has taken his jacket off and put it on, the whatever she does, he pours a scotch and has it at his desk at 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever it is,
you know,
in the morning.
I used to work at a place that remained nameless. We had the open cubicles. And
is this Boston Magazine?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
The guy behind me, I could hear him, the ice cubes and the cocktails.
Is that really true?
Yes, it started very early in the day.
Was this Boston Magazine?
I have no comment.
It was not
Boston Magazine.
Okay, so essentially the moral of this particular segment of the show is do whatever you have to do. Like, I think it was Eric, go home, walk the dog, go eat out. I'm telling you, even 30 minutes sitting down.
That's right.
This is one of the few things I really know something about.
You do.
Take the break. Do it. It changes everything.
Even though, of course, you never do it because you are a very important man.
No, actually, today, after the show, I'm going to go walk the dog.
Okay.
You have a dog I can walk?
I do have a dog. I'll let him know you're coming over. When we come back, it is time for Open Mic with Alex Beam. How does he feel about a U.S.-Canada merger? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie and I were discussing this morning, why do we call him Alex Beam? It's not because it's his birth name, but because, like Jim Beam, Marjorie, he is distilled and has that straight out of the barrel, no nonsense way about him. Wouldn't you agree?
That's right.
Joining us right now, he's a columnist for the Boston Globe and the author of many books, would be that very same Alex Beam. Hey, Alex.
It's nice to see you both. I used to have a Twitter handle called Ishmaelx. I thought it was a really clever idea. Call me Ishmael, call me.
That is pretty good.
Yeah, isn't that
fantastic? How'd that work out for you? Not that well?
Yeah, like six followers or something. Unbelievable.
Okay. So let's get to your column, Crowdsourcing Casablanca. Now tell people what Amazon is doing now about selecting what they choose to produce. This is fascinating.
Oh, yeah, it is fascinating. I stole the whole thing from a fantastic article in the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, I got a vituperative email from Jonathan Alter, the semi-famous Jonathan Alter, who's a producer on this show called Alpha House. Anyway, the deal is Amazon is trying to get into the television business, as obviously Netflix did with House of Cards. And Amazon has made much of how they're using data that they've collected on their website to kind of focus group or crowdsource the five programs that they've committed to putting on their – they're not, of course, putting them on air, so to speak. They're putting them on their website. The lead one is written by Gary Trudeau. It's called Alpha House.
As in Doonesbury Gary Trudeau, for those who
Doonesbury
don't know.
Doonesbury Gary Trudeau.
Is he a classmate of yours?
No, 5 years ahead.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And five times as talented, if you must know. Okay.
Beat me to it.
There's a it's a great – I've seen actually every episode of Alpha House that you can see for free.
Tell us what it's – tell people what it's about,
well,
Alpha
it's based on this famous story, alas, that I wrote for the Boston Globe but got scooped on by Mark Leibovich of the New York Times. It's based on this actual Capitol Hill townhouse that Senator Charles Schumer – a couple of other people, and Rep. Bill Delahunt.
They used to live in.
And they actually
wild
live,
and
like,
crazy
Schumer's
guy.
Living there in his, like, and they see each other in their underwear. They don't even wear boxer shorts. They wear jockeys. It's really gruesome. And anyway.
Do you know who was Anthony Weiner's roommate for years and years? Mike Capuano, by the way. This is what they do down there so they can afford multiple houses.
Exactly. It's part of a much larger and more and complex story about actually how little money they make. Mm-hmm. And so they have to pay. They have to really group. They live together in this kind of bunkhouse atmosphere. Anyway, so to get back to your original question. So Amazon, quote unquote, crowdsourced various. In other words, they posted the pilots on their website. And then just like they ask you to rate this book, how did you like this book? They asked you. They asked their literally a million viewers they got over the course of 5 months. Rate this pilot. What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? And they would use those in a sense as notes, you know, production notes that they would then feed back to the producers and say, look, here's what people want from this pilot. Here's what people don't like about this pilot. I have not seen any of the other shows. I'm a little bit in – one of them is an animation, and there's obviously three that I'm not remembering.
But you appear appalled, Trina Collin. What's wrong
I'm
with
appalled.
Getting feedback? I know you are. Why are you both appalled with the notion that the viewer could actually help the producers develop a show? What's wrong with that?
Okay, appalled. It's all kind of – don't let the glasses fool you. That was a – that was a great headline, Crowdsourcing in Casablanca.
It is.
I just read that piece and I realized I can get a column out of this because I know Leslie Epstein at Boston University. I know that Leslie is obsessed with his father and his uncle, who were the two co-writers of Casablanca. And I bet I can go to Ruben's Deli in Brookline, sit down with Leslie, and get him to trash the notion of quote-unquote crowdsourcing and beautiful art, which he did. Having said that, I mean, there's a whole gray area here. When you're writing a column, avoid gray areas. I mean, all great Hollywood movies, with a possible exception of Casablanca, I mean, are crowdsourced in the sense that, you know, they take them to Arizona, they show them in remote theaters, they show them to test audiences, they test endings. That's not the case with Casablanca for various reasons. But I don't know.
Well, we should say what the great quotes are that you pulled in your piece from Leslie Epstein.
Yeah.
There are two of them. Go ahead.
We got it right here. I've got it in front of me, so I'll read it if you don't mind. This is from Leslie Epstein. Quote, The artist is intended to impose his vision upon the audience and not the other way around.
And that follows him saying if the audience had its way, Rick would have run off with the girl, meaning Ingrid Bergman. Pretty great.
I have to say, Leslie's a really wonderful guy. And actually, what I love about him, I wouldn't call him a close personal friend at all. He really loves what his uncle and his father did.
That's great.
And it is quite an accomplishment to re-see that movie.
Okay. Now, before we leave this topic, Alex, what I would like you to do without thinking, I want you to do it as soon as I
do
want you
everything
to use,
without
I want
thinking.
You to use the word lapidary in a sentence. Go ahead. Now, when you decide to put a word like that in a column, are you not sitting at your computer saying, no one is going to have any idea what this means, and I'll torture them. And look at the look on his face. That is what you were thinking.
I hate people who use words like lapidary. And for the record, I hate people. I've never used the adjective eponymous in a column. Never.
Eponymous.
And I never will. Rewatched the classic, meaning Casablanca, last week. This is Alex writing. And marveled at its obvious strengths. Tight pacing, the glowing silver palette of the indoor shots, here's the key, and the lapidary dialogue that college kids use to parrot word for word at the Orson Welles in Cambridge. So lapidary means what?
Lapidary means, in a sense, beautifully etched, beautifully cut, like a beautiful stone.
That's right. And what did Jim Browdy and I both do this morning when
Dictionary.com.
Dictionary.com.
You know, I'm for that.
What does lapidary mean?
Kind of blowhard that uses a word like
lapidary. Don't remember since the SATs.
I'll give you a great word, by the way. I've been sort of monitoring Adam Gopnik, who has this astonishing reputation as a writer for The New Yorker. And twice in the same week, he's used the adjective larksome, which I'm thinking of working into a column. I'm mentioning him.
How do you spell
in
that?
In fact, in a larksome, L-A-R-K-S-O-M-E. It's a great, great adjective. And I mentioned him in today's piece, but I'm afraid I didn't get the adjective larksome in there.
Okay.
But it means whimsical.
It doesn't sound like it means whimsical.
Yeah, it does.
I like it when words sound like what they mean. You know what I mean?
You mean like lapidary.
Like lapidary.
Hey, right. Alex.
It does not sound elegant.
Eponymous is so confusing. What does eponymous sound like? It sounds like nothing. Oh, it sounds like your name.
Alex, I hate to bring this next topic up because last week we learned that you had not read virtually any of the stories in the Boston Globe. So we're hoping that you've read this one. This is by Todd Wallach, who's a great reporter, does great higher ed stuff. I really started the Evan Dobell Westfield State thing. A gilded goodbye for many private college leaders. And what the story is about is retirement pay, which I didn't even know existed for a lot of these leaders of, presidents of private and public colleges, sometimes running into the millions of dollars. Since you always call it the world's greatest university, the first thing I thought about was the great Larry Summers. Larry Summers was making $580,000 a year after he left on this year-long sabbatical, after he left as Harvard's president.
In 2006, too. It was a while ago.
At the same time that he was earning $5 million a year from some hedge fund. Did this story trouble you? Did it bother you at all?
Well, I read it really closely. It was a terrific story. As you know, it mainly focused in on Brandeis University's retired president, Yehuda Reinhart.
Do you know him?
I've been in a public radio studio with him for an hour.
Really?
Yeah, he's a very annoying guy, if you must know.
Wow.
But he came off as very annoying in that story. I mean, we should go into a few details, perhaps.
Well, they point out, okay, here's the lead of the story. When he stepped down 3 years ago, he moved back into his old office at Brandeis. But unlike everybody else there, he didn't teach any classes or supervise graduate students or go to any meetings or anything. People were confused about if he was even officially on the faculty. Yet he received more than $600,000 in salary and benefits in 2011 alone, second only to the new Brandeis president. And that's on top of $800,000 he earned in his new job as president of the something called the Mandel Foundation, which gives lots of money to Brandeis. Now, we should also point out that during this time he was raking in all this money. Remember, they wanted to shut down, and he was
the Rose Art Museum,
because they didn't have enough money. I am incensed by this story, and the reason I'm incensed by the story is the nut graph, as we say in the business, which talks about the fact that education's cost has soared 70% in the last decade, and the number of administrative jobs have increased 57%. 5% during that time. And if you and Jim, we've all done this. We've all visited colleges lately with our children. And, I mean, they have not only these extraordinary salaries for these administrators, everybody's building like the Olympic Village for their gyms. And they have 17,000 different kinds of sushi in the cafeteria, which is open from 7 in the morning till 2 o'clock in the morning. What has happened
to
these colleges?
This is kind of a scandal. Also, the last time I was on the Brandeis campus, I mean, unbelievably, you know, the pavement was cracking. If you go up to, by the way, you know, Kunin runs a church up there, and I went to his church. I'm the Reverend Walter Kunin, a Catholic.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful priest.
Yeah, he's a great priest. And he at least the last time I went up there a couple of years ago, he does Sunday Mass up there. And it's unbelievable. The whole place is, the concrete is cracking. I hate to use the word desuetude, but the campus was really in total desuetude.
Okay, but let's try.
But that's unusual because most campuses are state.
Yeah,
of
I mean, Brandeis
art.
Really did have other uses for this money.
Okay, I have two thoughts here that, in the spirit of fairness, which we should try to insert every once in a while. One of our colleagues, when we were discussing this story in the newsroom 2 or 3 days ago, she shall remain unnamed, say, with the exception of Jack Wilson, who is the former president of UMass, who got $425,000 a year on his sabbatical, according to the Globe, after he left in 2011 from a public university. All the rest of these are private. If they're private and they choose to pay their former presidents X hundreds of thousands of dollars, what the hell is it our business?
Well, I mean, you of all people, proletarian rabble-rouser, that's like saying, you've been talking on your own show about, you know, the relationship, just because like a CEO pays him or herself 500 times what the average worker. I mean, we disapprove of that.
That was the correct answer. Okay, yeah.
Wait a minute. You were joking with that question.
No, I don't agree with it. I just said one of our colleagues brought that up.
Oh.
She shall remain unnamed, a very smart woman.
I know who it is. But obviously, no one's going to be able to retire in the baby boom generation because of the college costs of putting their kids through school. I mean, this is just highway robbery. And on top of this, if they can afford to pay all this money to these presidents, why cannot they afford to pay more in taxes to cities like Boston, which are getting next to nothing?
That's a good point. I mean, context is relevant here. I mean, Brandeis is like a pretty good liberal arts college/university that could be better. And if Reinhartz were here, of course, he would gas on about how he made it much, much better. But still, I mean, there's other uses for this money.
Okay, but wait a second. Here's the other argument where I am totally down with Reinhartz, and I wasn't with the first one. Give us the topics of some of your recent books, Alex. What have you written about? You wrote about McLean. What else have you written about?
Oh, I could never rival
okay,
you.
Okay, fine. Now, here's what he is doing.
Yes, he's
he wouldn't
on
get
a,
in the story in the Globe by Todd Wallach. He would not get into specifics about what he did to earn his salary now at Brandeis, with one exception. Quote, the one area where Reinhartz was specific about how he spent his time, this is true, was his own research, including a book he is co-writing, I don't know who the co-author is, on the history of the donkey in literature, arguing that the animal, this is true, is often used as a substitute for people. There's smart donkeys, stupid donkeys, evil donkeys, etc. No one has ever contemplated this on a large scale. It is probably, this is a quote from him, the most ambitious topic I have ever contemplate. Now, that has no value.
I can give you an incredible fact about this book. This book is going to be published in Hebrew. I'm serious. Todd Wallach told me that.
Is he not? Is he from Israel?
Yes.
Fine, right. Okay. Yes. How sad for us who wanted to know more about Shrek. I can only hope for the speedy English translation.
But you know what else it drives me nuts about this? This did not used to be the way of the world in higher education. John Silber took a lot of flack when he...
But you know who started it.
John Silber did. It does not mean it has to continue. And
former
just because
president of BU, for
these
those
big
who
corporations
don't know,
do these golden parachutes, which are fairly nauseating. They are big corporations, but when these colleges, even when they're private, do these golden parachutes, which has become the rule now instead of the exception, obviously that's part of the reason that it costs $60,000 to send your kid to school to a private university in 2013.
Yeah, it's part of the reason. I mean, at the end of that story, hilariously, what Wallach interviewed the former president of I think Worcester Polytechnic Institute,
Edward A. Parrish.
Yeah, took $45,000 away from his job.
He got moving expenses. Essentially, is all he asked for. So there are some in the field who don't try to bleed the stone dry.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Worcester Polytech is a very good deal, too. A very good school at a reasonable price.
Yes, it's an excellent school at a reasonable price.
Yes, it is. You can go there and become an engineer.
and actually get a job.
And actually get a job.
When you study
sadly,
now,
Alex, my children can do their math.
Hermeneutics at Brandeis won't be getting you.
Exactly.
Alex Bean, always work in public radio.
Of the Boston Globe. Now, while you have not written about donkeys, which is unfortunate, you have written about something a lot of us have been thinking about a lot. I mean, for years, Marjorie and I have been debating this issue.
We have.
Should the United States and Canada merge? Now, we had a guy in the studio a couple of weeks ago who thought we should annex. Boston should annex. Cambridge, Arlington, Brookline, maybe even Newton, by the way, which I
hands
thought
off
had,
free Newton.
Had some was some merit to it. What's your take on this potential U.S.-Canada merger that this person proposed?
My take on it is a pretty darn easy column if you're looking for something to write about. Now, this lady, I was amazed. I forget how I found out about this.
Wall Street Journal, perhaps? Again?
No, I know. No, it wasn't the Wall Street Journal. A separate. I was tipped to the fact that Diane Francis, who's I've spoken with her, she's really intelligent, rational, somewhat unfunny and humor impaired Canadian professor. Oh. Can you imagine? Canadian professor of management in Toronto. And she's written this book called something like, you know, The Great Merger, or The Necessary Merger, making a very kind of coherent case. It's really directed more at Canadians as to why they, in a sense, should allow themselves to be swallowed up by the United States.
And what's the basic argument? What's your
basic? That's a good question.
Money.
Thank you.
The basic it's interesting. I mean, she's really not stupid. I wish she was funnier because it's kind of a funny subject. But the basic argument is that Russia has grabbing the Arctic. Russia has said the Arctic is ours, hands off. And China is trying to buy all the Canadian extraction companies. That's sort of the one area of the world economy where Canada and Australia are in the lead. They mine everything. And now China has all the money. They want to buy all of Canada's extraction companies. So she says, we need the American army, basically, to keep Russia and China at bay. And B, Canada has a huge labor shortage. I was literally just on the Canadian immigration website. They need 250,000 immigrants a year. And so part of her thesis, again, this is an intelligent woman, is obviously that you know, labor could move northward. Skilled labor is what they're looking for. And we have greater reservoirs and greater access to skilled labor through our immigration policies.
So do you ridicule her thesis other than her lack of humor? Is that your take on this?
You know, in a sense, I didn't ridicule her quite enough because I love Canada. I just freaking love Canada.
So clean. You ever notice that? You go to the bathrooms. If you're driving cross country, you stop at the public restrooms in Canada. They're spotless.
Excellent point,
I don't know
Marjorie.
How they do that. But
you know what she also told me? She said, I mean, Canada is actually on its back in some respects, mainly due to we've sort of closed the border with Canada. Sort of Americans don't know that and Americans don't care. And that's fine. But Canadians know that and Canadians care. Their American tourism has gone off by one third. That was probably like their second or third. You know.
I'm with this completely, though, because I
what,
read
the
this.
Annexation
absolutely.
Or the merger?
I'm down exactly. with it because the International exactly. Monetary Fund says by 2018, China's economy is going to dwarf ours. And then our living standards are going to continue to decline and we have to do something about it.
Well, there's another great reason. If we did it really, really quickly, Rob Ford would be an American mayor.
Exactly.
I mean, we couldn't get much better
Why
there.
Not? He and Anthony Weiner could hang out.
It's really...
Fat crackheads. We don't have enough of them south of the border.
You know, I have to say, taking on this issue was very lapidary of you, Alex. It really was.
Well, I'm not falling into desuetude quite yet, Jim.
It's an eponymous move on Alex's part.
Alex Beam, it's a pleasure as always. Nice to see you.
You guys are funny. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe and the author of many books, but we're not allowed to tell you which ones.
Exactly.
They are.
They're all on the index.
There's a new one coming out in April, and we'll tell you when the time comes. Thanks, Alex, as always.
Take care.
Yeah, I just realized I made a mistake, which I want to correct before we move forward. I mentioned Todd Wallach, who'd written that piece about the university president's retirement pay, for lack of a better expression. I said he wrote the piece on the former president of Westfield State, Marjorie Evan Dobell. In fact, of course, that was written by Scott Allen and Andrea Estes. They wrote a whole great series on Dobell.
Okay, when we come back, pilot Patrick Smith joins us to take your questions and ours. We'll go over a new FAA report on pilot training, what you're likely to encounter at the airports this holiday season, and are we any safer in the air today than we have been in years past? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 to take our questions and yours is Patrick Smith. Patrick's an airline pilot. You can read his great blog at askthepilot.com. He has a new book out, Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel. Patrick, very good to see you.
Thank you for
good
coming.
Good to be back. Thank you.
You for coming
you
in,
had
Patrick.
A pause and decide whether it was good to be back? There was like a 7-second delay in there. What's that about?
I didn't know if I should direct it towards you or towards
Marjorie. That's right. That's
or,
right. We're at the opposite sides of the studio here. Our numbers, by the way, if you want to call in and ask some questions of Patrick, are is 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. The email address is bpr@wgbh.org. So I want to start, Patrick. I want to ask you about this merger, American Airlines and US Air. Is this going to be bad for ticket fares?
I don't think so. And that's the question that comes up every time there's a merger. And we've seen, three or four very large mergers in the past decade, mega mergers, consolidation of the industry, which really ultimately is going to result in a healthier, more reliable industry for everybody. In some markets, fares will probably go up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't they? If you reduce competition, we end up with four or five major airlines. Why aren't they? Why wouldn't they go? Why are you? I hope you're right, but why are you optimistic?
Particularly at larger hubs where single carriers dominate, fares from those hubs tend to be higher. That mm-hmm. stands to reason. But higher is not necessarily the same as high. And let's just talk about fares in general for a second. And this is something that's lost on a lot of people. That is just how affordable flying is nowadays. It wasn't all that long ago that only a small fraction of the population could afford to fly at all. You know, the idea of college kids going off to Cancun and flying home for Thanksgiving weekend. I mean, that didn't used to happen because
flying
was so expensive.
No, it shouldn't be happening now, Patrick, actually, but it is.
Airfares, on average, right now, are about half of what they were 30 years ago when you adjust. 50%. Mm. And that includes, by the way, factoring in all of those ancillary fees that everybody hates and that airlines love.
Baggage.
Here's a quote. This is from Air Transport World magazine.
Love that magazine. What do they say?
One of my favorites. That fares between the year 2000 and the year 2013, so over the past 13 years, fares have fallen 18%.
Wow. The reason I find that hard
on
to believe,
average,
I'm not quarreling.
Meanwhile, Jim, fuel over that same span has increased by about 42%.
Yeah,
so costs for carriers are going up, fares are coming down, which is one of the reasons you've seen this kind of inherent instability in the industry. But they're starting to get a grasp on that.
But it depends. Obviously, I know this is an obvious statement. It depends on the route. 75% of the flights I've taken in my whole life are back and forth from New York City. I remember it was not so long ago when the choices were far wider, when there even things like People Express existed. If you remember that far back, $19 each way. On that route, at least, it's a lot more expensive in real dollars than it was 10, 15 years ago, right?
Well, fares do vary market to market, and there are some markets where fares on average are maybe higher than they used
to be. Because the demand is so
colossal. Because of the demand and all of the other variables that go into airfare pricing. But even with that example, I don't know if I necessarily agree with you because you've got Delta Shuttle, U.S. Airways Shuttle, you've got JetBlue, you've got American. There's four carriers
right
there serving
the market. But there's not a real cheap option.
How much does it cost to take the shuttle to New York?
$250 round trip, $300 round trip, that sort of thing?
The time of day that you go, the day of the week, it varies.
How often, if you really want to get a deal, how often do you have to book your flight?
It depends.
Like 6 months?
It depends.
Yeah.
As a general rule, the sooner you buy your ticket, the more affordable it's
going to
be.
Can you buy it
like
a year?
Not always.
Can you buy a year in advance?
You can in some cases.
Wow.
Sure.
Wow.
You also alerted us to this thing. There are so many issues around flying, but since you are a pilot by trade, you alerted us to the fact that the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, is going to be releasing some report this week on pilot training relating to automation and those sort of things. What are they going to tell us, and is it going to be disconcerting?
Yeah, the report actually came out a couple of days ago. I think the Wall Street Journal broke it.
And what did it say?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with the FAA's conclusions, which is that pilots aren't as proficient as at manual hands-on flying as we used to be. But what worries me is how the public interprets that. You know, already out there, there's this idea, and this is something that I rant about in my book. There's this idea that cockpit automation is so advanced that the computers, quote-unquote, fly the plane and the pilots just kind of sit there and occasionally push a few buttons and we're just monitoring. I mean, that's completely not true. And so this, I think, the way this report is written sort of reinforces that myth. And that
pilots are so dependent on automation, which you say is not true, that they're so dependent on automation that their own skill level Correct. Is on the decline.
I mean, and what do terms like automatic and manual even mean? I don't think the average passenger really has a grasp of that. I mean, the line I use in the book is automation doesn't fly the aircraft. The pilots are flying the aircraft through the automation, if that makes sense. We still have to tell it what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And a cockpit can become very, very busy, even with all of the automation on.
That's the voice of Patrick Smith. You can check out his website, which is askthepilot.com. What is our number again?
Our number is 877-301-8970. Before we get to the phone calls at 877-301-8970, I want to ask you one more thing. All this talk now about how we're going to be able to keep our iPods, whatever's, Kindles, on takeoff and landing. We don't
Whole
have to
deal.
Wait till 10,000 feet. Good thing?
I think
no, not to be worried about the plane crashing.
I think it's a good thing, and it was an inevitable thing for this to happen.
So this is a big lie about how we're interfering with
just to be clear, the new rules pertain only to tablet devices, not to laptop computers, and certainly not to cell phones, which is, you know, the next conversation here.
Well, you can put your cell phone in airplane mode. You mean you can't make a phone call, or you can't text, or you can't do that sort of thing. Is that right?
Right. And I think people, with the new rules coming out, people are asking, okay, now what's next? Is it just a matter of time before the regulations on cell phones are lifted? And
I hope not.
I hope not, too.
That'd be awful.
It's not because of technological concerns that I worry about it. It's the social aspect of it. Do we really
want
to be sitting on a plane with 200 people all talking on their phones at the same time?
I'm amazed you can talk on your phones at 35,000 feet.
Well, you can't right now because of the way it works. But the technological remedy for that is something that is easy to take care
of.
But carriers for now, at least in this country, just aren't going there because they don't want to deal with this other aspect of
it. Can you imagine sitting next to someone from Boston to California with their cell phone the whole time?
It's hard enough just sitting next to someone, much less sitting next to someone.
It's interesting because our airports, U.S. airports, are so loud with the PA announcements, you know, sometimes playing two and three at a time, those horrible news monitors at every gate. It's not until you get on the airplane often enough that you really find some relaxation and peace and quiet. I mean, granted, there's ambient noise when you're on a plane, engine noise, air noise. But really, it's a much more relaxing atmosphere than the airport.
And it's true.
I hope we keep it that way.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you have a question for Ask the Pilot, also known as Patrick Smith. You know, Patrick, here's how I would reorganize the auto industry, the airline industry. There is nothing more aggravating to me that you got to pay for everything. You got to pay a buck for the headphones. Of course, you can bring your own. If you want something more than peanuts, you got to pay $3 for that. Many of the airlines now, you're paying for your first bag, much less your second or third bag. I read a couple of weeks ago they're contemplating figuring out how they can charge you for overhead so you can't avoid it. That way, wouldn't the happiness quotient of the flying public be higher? I haven't done a survey. I'm just speaking for myself. If instead of charging me $25 for this, two for that, three for this, they raised everybody's fare, let's say $31 on average, I'm obviously making up a number, and everything is on the house. Wouldn't it? Because there's so much to complain about. There's so much nickel and diming. It literally drives you, at least me, over the edge.
You might see at some point in the future an airline or two moving back to that model because of the frustration levels over these ancillary fees. Now, going back to what I was saying a minute ago, even when you factor these fees in, fares are still a lot less than they were even 10, 15 years ago. But the psychological aspect of it, you're right. People feel nickel and dimed. And you know, that's not good PR, whatever you want to call it. However, I think there's a good side to the fees, to the ancillary fees. That is, it allows certain people, certain passengers, to pay for certain things that not everybody wants. And that allows fares to stay lower across the board for everybody on average. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But here's my
and those things.
I took psychology 101 in college, so I know everything about this. Here's what I'm going to tell you.
Well, hold on. First of all, let's be clear that these things were never free.
I understand.
They were included
in
the price of the ticket, and that ticket used to be
right. It's like when
expensive.
They say free shipping for your new couch. Obviously, it's built on your couch, but it's all psychological. That was my point. Let's assume you want to save a few bucks, and you can make the choice. When you're sitting and eating peanuts because you want to save, or little tiny pretzels because you want to save $11 on the sandwich. And the guy next to you or the woman next to you is spending the $11 on the sandwich. I at least get angry at everybody. I get angry at the guy next to me. I'm hoping he's going to give me a piece. I get angry at the airlines. I am really telling you, when you speak to airline executives next, say an expert consumer.
Jim,
that would be me. What?
I think you should pony up the $11.
Well, I do, by the way. I do, but I'm telling you, it has an impact on people.
Let's take some phone calls. Bill is calling from Cape Cod. Hi, Bill. You're on with Patrick Smith, the pilot.
Hi, everybody. This is Bill. But, Patrick, my question is related to your comment about the degree of automation. Wasn't that Asiana airline that crashed in San Francisco, weren't they on autopilot as they made that approach, that final approach?
Well, what does autopilot even mean? I mean, you have on the plane what I prefer to call an auto flight system. I mean, there are so many different components to it. I mean, there's not just an on-off button. I'd have to go back and look at the second-by-second analysis of that accident to find out which components were working. The gist of that accident was the auto throttle, which is one of those components, had been switched off or had failed, and for some reason the crew didn't realize that, even though they should have. I mean, there's lights and sounds that come on when that happens.
But, Bill, your point was that assuming you're factually right, whatever terminology you're using, that over-reliance on what you and I will call automation was a huge part of the problem. Is that where you're going?
I used to fly internationally a lot.
Yeah.
And I remember when the 747-400 series was introduced, I was flying to Tokyo, and the guy in the next seat to me was a United Airlines pilot that was heading to Tokyo to pick up a flight somewhere. And he basically, I can't remember the technical description he gave me, but he basically indicated that airplanes of that era, this is 15 years ago, were capable, literally, of putting the data into the computer, powering up the airplane and taxiing to position, and from that point on, the plane could literally take off and land itself.
No, that's completely false.
Bill, thanks for the call.
That's totally false. You know, pilots, we're sometimes our own worst enemies with this stuff. We say things like that, like, oh, this plane just flies itself, and we don't realize people take that literally. It's much more complicated than that. And another thing people should understand, landings, although there is such a thing as an auto land, where, to put it crudely, the plane lands itself. Those are very rare in day-to-day operation. I see maybe three or four of them a year. More than 99% of landings are, I don't want to use the term old-fashioned because that's really not right, but the hands-on manual variety. The pilots are landing the plane, and meanwhile, a full 100% of all takeoffs are manual. There's no such thing in all of commercial aviation as an automatic takeoff.
Yeah, speaking of landing, Lewis or Luis from Dedham is asking the question that demands an answer today. Is it Lewis or Luis?
It's Luis.
Luis, thank you so much for the call. This is the perfect question directed to Patrick Smith.
I'm scared.
Go ahead, Luis.
Hi.
Not Luis. We didn't mean you. We'll get to you in 2 seconds, I promise. Luis, okay. Are you still there? Ask the question.
What's the question? Go ahead.
Okay, quickly. We just learned that a pilot landed in the wrong airport, a 747, about 7 miles from the airport he should have landed in. Can you just give us a sense of how you think that may have been possible?
Great question.
Thank
and by
you.
The way, we just saw this morning him trying to take off because the runway is too short at this airport that he wasn't supposed to go to for him to take off. How did that happen?
Well, Jim's point first. There's no fixed distance that an airplane needs to be able to take off. This is something I talk about in the book in Chapter 3. It always depends on the weight of the airplane, the weather conditions, wind, temperature, elevation, and so forth. It can really vary. And what happened is this 747 carrying Boeing parts, it was a freighter, for lack of a better term, landed at the wrong airport with a small runway in Kansas,
Yeah.
Can a 747 take off on a 6,000-foot runway?
No. Okay, forget that. I accept that. But how did it end? Luis's question, which is the good one. How did it end up seven miles from the one it was supposed to land at?
I don't know. And I shake my head. But here's something. A number of years ago, there was a plane, a passenger flight in Europe that landed at the wrong airport. They were supposed to be going to Amsterdam, and they ended up in Hamburg or something like that, or Frankfurt. But when you looked at it, what really happened is air traffic control had given them a series of confusing vectors and routings, and they thought the airplane was going to where it wasn't really going. And actually, the crew realized in the final minutes of the flight that they were lined up for the wrong airport. But because of their fuel situation at the time, they decided to continue and land at that airport, refuel, figure out the logistics, and then go to where they were supposed to be going. So it wasn't really as simple as landing at the wrong airport. It's always more complicated.
Hey, they're only off by 7 miles. Now we're going to get to Louise. We almost did before. You're in Somerville, Louise. Thanks for the call.
Yes. I was calling about the JetBlue incident that just happened where the slide blew up in the plane, almost crushing a stewardess. And passengers said that the turbulence was unbelievable.
Yeah, what happened?
So can you tell us, can you kind of give us a scenario or what the heck happened there?
And we only have 45 seconds, Patrick.
Yeah, I was reading about this in the Globe today. I didn't know about the turbulence part of it, but the bottoms of the main cabin doors are equipped with these emergency escape slides that inflate. And apparently the very strong turbulence caused one of these slides to deploy into the cabin, pinning the flight attendant against the bulkhead or whatever. You know, potentially very serious, but not catastrophic.
Oh, gosh. I want to talk about overhead baggage. Can we ever get rid of it? Because that drives me crazy. And the airplane takes you like a half an hour to get off the airplane because everybody's fighting over their overhead baggage. And TSA pre-approved status. Can you tell us really quickly, is there such a thing as being a TSA pre-approved at random? Yes or no?
Pre-approved at random? I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay. To be continued.
My understanding is frequent travelers can do some sort of search thing. Where pre-check. Yeah,
which is a good idea. I just wish they weren't charging people money for it.
My point exactly,
don't charge people to go around the problem.
You finally got it, Patrick Smith.
Like
thanks so much.
Like Alitalia, American Airlines should give you nice free food. Anyway, Patrick Smith, we have to continue this. We didn't get to all our stuff. You can read his blog at askthepilot.com. His new book, Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Airlines. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for our Thanksgiva. I said that wrong, Jim.
Thanksgiva quiz.
Thanksgiva news quiz. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening.